Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Eric Kahn was once one of the top disability lawyers in the country. Today, Eric Kahn is in prison for running the largest Social Security scam in U.S. history. The $600 million fraud orchestrated by Kahn left his clients in a legal mess. There's a four-part documentary about this, The Big Kahn, on Apple TV+. Prestonsburg attorney Ned Pillersdorf, who represents many of Kahn's victims, was interviewed for the documentary. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Ned.
I appreciate you having me.
So many of us have followed the Eric Kahn matter, but for listeners who haven't or maybe are new to the area, if you could give us kind of the Cliff Notes version of this case.
Well, it's been a seven-year nightmare here in Appalachia. The Social Security Administration, as a result of Kahn's bribery of the judge, has really put 3,800 of my neighbors here through the ringer. We've had a seven-year legal battle, and it is still going on, and it's been a true humanitarian crisis. One of the big misconceptions about this whole nightmare, and it's been a nightmare, is that the crime Kahn committed that netted him a 27-year sentence was basically he bribed the judge. Kahn was located in Sandville in Floyd County. The judge was in Huntington. They met halfway in Louisa. And Kahn basically bribed the judge about $9,000 a month, and this went on for several years. Unfortunately, the Social Security Administration has decided to target the former Kahn clients who had no idea this was going on. And one of the things I've learned during this seven-year legal battle, I've yet to meet the first former client of Eric Kahn who ever met Eric Kahn. But, you know, the Social Security Administration has proceeded on what I call a throwback to the days of Joe McCarthy. It's guilt by association. Since Kahn was your lawyer, we're going to put you through these hearings that are really rigged against them. And, you know, people say, well, wait a minute, they're putting people through hearings to see if they're truly disabled, and they ought to be suspicious. The problem was the hearings... First of all, the Social Security Administration waited for years to institute the hearings, which the documentary really describes in detail. I've seen the first 2 hours of the documentary. But, you know, every hearing was truly a throwback to the days of Joe McCarthy. They would start out and say, well, Mr. Martin, your lawyer is Eric Kahn, and there's a secret finding of fraud that you can't challenge. And any evidence Kahn submitted, including diagnostic tests, x-rays, IQ tests, is automatically inadmissible. The good news for in this seven-year battle, which has been awful, is we have won throughout the entire court system. Those rules were declared unconstitutional. And as a result, about 250 former Kahn clients, we managed to get their benefits back, which is a big deal, frankly. Unfortunately, the Social Security Administration, they're talking about having another 1,800 hearings this year. And what I've been doing for the last 7 years is basically finding volunteer lawyers, or at this point we're transitioning over to law students, to represent the former Kahn clients. So that's kind of in a short version of this seven-year battle that's still going on.
I know it's asking a lot to kind of squeeze that into a couple of minutes, but if you could expand a little bit on what kinds of hardships Kahn's Kahn, if you will, created in the lives of the people that you represent?
Well, I mean, the first thing that happened were the suicides. The anecdote that I tell that really sums it up, it was Memorial Day weekend, it was a beautiful day, I was driving home, and I got a call from a local lawyer that one of our common clients, actually in a property case, had just received a letter from the Social Security Administration immediately suspending the benefits. And on the other line was a Billy Stepp from the Herald Leader, and he said, Ned, I understand there's 900 former Kahn clients who got the letter. And I got back to the local attorney, and I said, it's not just our client, it's 900. And the local attorney said, oh, Ned, there'll be suicides. And he was prophetic. 10 days later, the suicides started. And it's fair to say there was mass hysteria here. You know, the people they targeted, you know, we're in an economically distressed area. And the people they targeted are the most emotionally and economically vulnerable people in this nation. And for 7 years, we've had just unrelenting battle. The good news on the horizon and is President Biden did go ahead and clean house at the Social Security Administration. The people orchestrating this, Biden fired. We've had mixed signals whether or not they're going to continue going after these people. And, you know, frankly, we're hoping the documentary is a big deal. And we went to the grand premiere in Austin, Texas, and the first 2 hours was a real damning documentary on how corrupt and awful the Social Security Administration has been. The first 2 hours, the best way to describe it is there were two whistleblowers who were heroic who figured out this bribery was going on in 2005 and 2006, and like nothing happened for 5 or 6 years. And this is going to sound over the top. Nothing happened because when the SSA learned what the whistleblowers were reporting, they entered into this criminal conspiracy to frame them. And that's just not hyperbole. The chief judge of the Huntington office actually went to federal prison for trying to frame one of the whistleblowers. Mm. And, you know, I understand the next 2 hours, which I understand will premiere in Los Angeles, May 5th. At this point, they have invited myself and my wife out to the premiere. That's just going to be about, I hope the star of the show is the clients. They interviewed, I know, 17 former con clients. They interviewed me for 16, 18, 20 hours, followed me around. And we're frankly hoping that this documentary will catch the attention of the Biden administration, the Social Security administration, and finally end this 7-year-old nightmare, because we still have plenty of people around here in Floyd, Knott, McGoffin counties who are scared to go to their mailbox. It could be another letter from the SSA saying, mm-hmm. we're going to put you through a hearing, we're going to pull your benefits. And by the way, when they pull your benefits, they also send you a letter when you're paying back the $100,000 in overpayments.
Oh, boy.
And we've had, you know, my count, probably 8 suicides. Like I say, the people they targeted are not your random sample of Appalachia. It's the most vulnerable people. And I would say, you know, seemed like half the clients I represent are illiterate. More than half have significant mental illness issues. And they've simply been terrorized by the Social Security Administration. You know, as bad as Khan was, you know, I blame him for 2% of this nightmare. It's the grotesque overreaction of the SSA that I blame. And I think if you go out and talk to the former Khan clients, they've, you know, everybody was outraged what Khan did. I mean, he held himself out as a friend of the less fortunate. And frankly, none of that was true. By the way, Khan never lifted a finger to help these people. Hmm. After all, hell broke loose. And he knows these people. He's a local guy. Mm-hmm. And he thwarted everything I was trying to do to help his former clients. He's serving a 27-year sentence. But unfortunately, the real story ought to be not about Khan's bizarre lifestyle, his 16 wives, whatever. It ought to be about the human tragedy he left behind in his wake of misconduct.
Well, what about the Social Security Administration? Is this a result of just mindless bureaucracy, or is there something even more sinister going on?
You know, I say this as someone who's lived in Appalachia for 41 years. In my opinion, and this is Ned Pillersdorf's opinion, I think this is all fueled by anti-Appalachian stereotypes. I am convinced to this day that if Khan clients had been a bunch of, you know, wealthy investors in the suburbs of Chicago, they never would have been victimized the way these people have, put through these really rigged, unfair hearings where, you know, we had to rely on volunteer lawyers. But, you know, I think they look down, you know, I think it's Beverly Hillbillies. They look down on the my neighbors here as shiftless, ignorant people who are willing to rip off the system. And that's not true. You know, my opinion, having done all this, and I've represented hundreds of former clients, I say probably 70, 75% of these people were truly disabled. And the tragedy has been, I'm convinced, truly disabled people who had mental illness problems, we, you know, have a lot of old broken down coal miners, have lost their benefits for no other reason than guilt by association. Eric Khan and they happen to live in Appalachia. You know, I really think when the SSA made the decision to target these people and declare war, I think they just condescendingly looked down at our neighbors here in Appalachia, and it was fueled by negative Appalachian stereotypes. And, you know, in the real world, sometimes a powerful documentary can change the course of history. You know, and we made a decision early on in representing the former con clients. I told them to go ahead and cooperate, to give interviews, tell your story. We have nothing to hide.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, you know, the big lie throughout all of this was when this all broke, a former Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn, he's quoted as saying all of the con clients were involved in the scam, and that's total zero truth to that. And we have been battling that big lie, that big falsehood, whatever you want to call it. And it has truly caused a humanitarian crisis among, you know, in my opinion, some of the most vulnerable people in our nation. You know, Khan has done incalculable damage to my profession. The good news is the lawyers who have swarmed in here to help me. This has been the greatest volunteer effort to help people probably in the history of our nation. We found lawyers for more than 1,000 hearings. We've been in probably a dozen different federal courts, and we're all volunteers. And I am, you know, so proud of my the volunteer network. And frankly, I'm a little uncomfortable with the attention I'm getting. I tell everybody I'm just a member of a team.
The true crime docuseries The Big Con is expected to drop on Apple TV Plus May 6th, along with an accompanying podcast on Apple Podcasts that same day. And among those interviewed for the documentary is our guest, Prestonsburg attorney Ned Pillersdorf. Thanks, Ned.
I appreciate you having me.
Ned Pillersdorf mentioned those negative perceptions of Eastern Kentucky, but there is a lot of effort being made to turn that page by making thoughtful use of something wonderful that we have, if only we agree to take better care of it. And that's what brings a $1.2 million grant from the Appalachian Regional Commission to support the marketing of Kentucky Wildlands, an outdoor recreation tourism branding initiative of Eastern Kentucky Pride, which stands for personal responsibility in a desirable environment. Tammy Nazario is Pride president and CEO, and she joins us from Somerset. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Tammy.
Well, thanks so much for having me today.
So Pride was started back in 1997 by Congressman Hal Rogers and the late General James Bickford, the former Secretary of the Kentucky Natural Resources and Environmental Protection Cabinet. And their idea was to restore the natural beauty of our region by encouraging people to take responsibility for protecting their environment and then by providing the education and the resources that they need to do that. How will this fresh infusion of funding support that mission?
We spent a lot of focus on just marketing our region in the first 2 years, but now we want to actually do a little more of that boots on the ground. What do we really need to do to regionalize tourism in our industry? And so as we've done a lot of research, there's definitely a need for hospitality training, which we are doing, and this grant will help fund additional hospitality training. We also are going to do some entrepreneurial program development for both youth and adults through this grant. And then, of course, we will definitely continue to market Southern and Eastern Kentucky as a tourism destination. Regional tourism is where we have to go with this. It's so important to our region because, as we all know, lodging can be an issue across our region, but we do all have the natural assets. So let's create those itineraries that bring people here for more than just that day visit. Let's bring them in and show them what we have to offer, but then let's also push them on over to the next city or county. Show off that city or county, because I don't think people know what we have to offer. And we are one of the most beautiful places in the world.
Well, we do have the beauty, that's for sure. Among our assets are waterways, rivers, streams, and some of them could use a little work. They need a little bit of cleaning up to make them more attractive as destinations. And speaking of taking responsibility for protecting the environment, April is your annual spring cleanup month. Tell us about that.
That's correct. And so we need everybody to take that pride in their community, in their region. And so during the entire month of April, we recruit volunteers. We encourage civic organizations, local municipalities, organize cleanup events across your region, and Pride has a very limited amount of supplies that we can send to you as far as trash bags, gloves, vests, those types of things. So those are only available on a first-come, first-served basis. So we recommend that you call our office early. You do have to have the plan of what cleanup you're going to do and approximately how many volunteers will you have, and we'll be more than happy to supply those supplies.
And what's that number to call?
888-577-4339.
Another of your goals, Tammy, is to clean up solid waste problems. What kinds of problems are you looking at?
Well, solid waste has definitely been an issue for many, many years, as we all know. I think we can all remember the days the appliances were dropped over the hillside. Also, you know, mandatory garbage is not in every one of our counties. And so a lot of times that's not affordable. And so we see different types of solid waste issues across. Just a few examples, Pride has eliminated 3,000 illegal dumps, and those can go from as small as your tiniest pickup, dropping 2 to 3 bags of trash off on the end of a street, or it can go up to hundreds of thousands of dollars that it's cost to clean these dumps up that were around for years and years and years. But thankfully, we're not seeing as many of those. So solid waste is definitely an issue.
It is an economic issue, isn't it? Because a lot of communities have seen declining property taxes. They've seen declining coal severance funds. The monies that might be used to support municipal trash haulage have declined. And, of course, private service is just out of reach for a lot of people. Is there a need to focus funding toward trash cleanup in the region?
I definitely think so. And there's a continual need for that cleanup. It's not just trash haulage. It's environmental education overall. I think it starts at the elementary level. You teach people you can't just throw your stuff out the window. And so as they grow up, you continue that environmental education. And then us as communities need to take a look at how do we work together to make sure that we can get this trash picked up.
Well, cleaning up the environment of Eastern Kentucky is obviously important for the well-being of the natural world and for people. But why is it important to economic development and tourism?
Well, simply put, people will not come to see our trash. We have the most beautiful assets, as I mentioned earlier. And they're not beautiful when they're littered with trash. And so nobody wants to take a drive down to the most beautiful waterfall you've ever seen. But then on your way down, you see your ditches full of trash. You see diaper trees hanging on your creek banks. And so that's very important for tourism. It's also very important for even corporations that want to relocate here. When they come in and they see that we don't have pride in our community, what makes them want to come into our community and have pride?
Mm-hmm. I believe in 2020, a couple of years ago, you launched the Kentucky Wildlands Hospitality Program. You touched on this a few minutes ago. And the theme is Elevate Your Service. What's that about, and why is it needed?
Hospitality is much needed throughout our service area. That was actually a recommendation that came from many people as we had a series of 6 town halls across the region when we started the Kentucky Wildlands. We had 350 people attend, and hospitality training just kept coming out and coming out because so many of us go into a hotel or a restaurant and we say, what is there to do here? Oh, well, there's nothing. You need to go on over to the next county. No, we have everything here. And so hospitality training is so important so that we can say, no, you have this waterfall that's over here. And so it's a matter of educating your frontline worker as well as your management level. And we offer both of those levels. We offer two different classes. Each are about 4 hours, and those are totally free of cost.
How about the concept of regionalism in the region? Are county officials showing a willingness to work together and cooperate?
Absolutely. I think the timing was just perfect for this. It was a time that everybody was ready. And so I think we're all realizing that we are in this together. And of course, as budgets get less and less, we all know that we have to work together on a more regional basis.
Well, Tammy, a study has been underway into whether and how to designate the Kentucky Wildlands a National Heritage Area. What would that mean?
A National Heritage Area would put Southern and Eastern Kentucky on the map, literally. A national designation brings in economic development. If we look to our neighbors to the right of us, the National Coal Heritage Area, in their 2016 year, they generated over $203 million in economic impact. They provided jobs through the national designation for nearly 3,000 people. So it could change the face of Southern and Eastern Kentucky.
Have you heard from people that that word national kind of makes them nervous?
Absolutely. And so I do want to put this out there because this will be maintained on a local level. Just because it's a national designation does not mean that it's going to be controlled anywhere else aside on a local level. Also, it does not mean that we are going to take your land. There is no money available to purchase land. There is nothing in the National Heritage Area designation that says that's even an option. So what this money allows for is technical assistance to build these tourism management plans that will allow us to continue to grow from there. And it provides a little bit of federal funding for us to be able to work together to do that.
Well, as I said earlier, April is Spring Cleanup Month, and I wanted to repeat that again. That's happening in the Kentucky Wildlands region. And one more time, Tammy, if you could, how can people get involved?
Please call our office at 888-577-4339. Also, I want to mention for the National Heritage Area designation, we need public comment. That is very important right now. You can go to our website at explorekywildlands.com. Along the first drop-down, you will see National Heritage Area. You can go there, and it will take you to a page of the National Park Service where you can go and provide public comment about how you feel personally, how this designation can help you. And so we want to highly encourage participation there because we need that.
All right, that's Tammy Nazario, President and CEO of Eastern Kentucky Pride, based in Somerset. Thank you, Tammy.
Thanks so much. Have a wonderful day.
Coming up after the break.
We're not having honest conversations about work, and I wanted to try to move that conversation to a better place.
And what does it take to succeed in the Nashville music scene?
Persistence. It takes a lot of persistence.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives. Members of local co-ops can receive renewable solar power through the Cooperative Solar Program. More information is at cooperativesolar.com.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
In addition to everything else going on in our world, there is this historic shift happening in our work preferences and habits. Here to talk about it with a special guest are Logan Jones and Evan Knowles from the Middle Tech Podcast.
We have an awesome guest here today that is going to talk a lot about the future of work, remote work and how companies should be adapting to the future now that we've seen this huge change that COVID has kind of caused. So we got to sit down with Steve Cadigan today. Steve has a pretty impressive background. He was the first chief of HR at LinkedIn. He is an advisor to multiple startups, and most recently, he has actually just published a book called Workquake, which dives into the topic of remote work and the future of work. So we got to have a really deep and great conversation with him about the future of work. And this is one that is especially important to the state of Kentucky. Those of you that follow me on LinkedIn might have seen that I got to talk on a panel about the future of remote work in Kentucky. Kentucky is really trying to invest in that right now. We see a future in that here in this state. So if you're a part of building up the future of remote work here in Kentucky, this is an episode you're definitely going to want to pay attention to. And one last thing, if you enjoy this conversation, you can find the full episode on the Middle Tech podcast feed by simply searching Middle Tech wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening. Let's dive on in.
And in your book, you talked about, you know, you came to a realization that there was something broken about the relationship between employees and employers when you were transitioning from EA to LinkedIn. And I want to talk about, just before we get into the COVID and what's happening now, what's going on in the future, what did you start to notice before COVID even happened? What was going on in the workplace that you just weren't sitting, that wasn't sitting right with you?
Yeah, well, thanks. Right. I guess we haven't mentioned that. I did just publish a book in August called Workquake. Super excited around the future of work and trying to build a better future of work. But I think over the last probably 20 years, what I've seen is something that didn't make sense. Candidates have more information to make better choices on where to go work than ever. And companies know more about candidates than any point. So why is everyone leaving faster? And the trend of turnover has been accelerating in the last 20 years. People are just staying in companies less time than ever. In the US in particular, in the last 6 years, we've seen a median tenure of 5 years for knowledge workers, white collar professionals, down to four. And in the demographic of 25 to 35 year olds, that's down to 2.8. So, I was sitting there looking at this data going, this doesn't make sense. People have the best information they've ever had. Why is disengagement going up according to Gallup, who does all these engagement polls? Why are people unhappier? Why is job satisfaction declining and people leaving faster when arguably we should be having the most intelligent choices of our career? So that led me to sort of say something doesn't feel right here, as well as a number of my own anecdotal experiences, which I cover in the book, which are just like, we're not having honest conversations about work. And I wanted to try to move that conversation to a better place.
So right when COVID hits, that's when everything kind of hits the fan, per se. Everyone is scrambling to try and figure out, you know, what is this new paradigm that we have to adjust to as everyone starts going remote? What are some of the trends that you were seeing pre-COVID start to get accelerated once COVID hit? What are some of those things that you kind of knew were going to come, but were accelerated by COVID?
People leaving companies faster. We've seen the highest number of voluntary resignations since we've been measuring it. We've seen the highest number of startups founded since we've been tracking startups being founded, which is super cool, right? And that's another, you know, overlay that was growing in awareness prior to the pandemic, which is the gig economy platforms that allow people to earn a living or make a living through multiple platforms are proliferating. So I have more choices on how to earn a living than working for somebody else. And that's pretty cool. And so the pandemic just super accelerated all that, you know, like to a massive degree. And then you overlay lots of new concerns on top of that. And the way I try to frame it in my book is what's really uncomfortable in the world of work going into the pandemic was both parties had limited view with certainty into the future. What skills do I need? What is my industry safe from disruption from some unicorn? What skills do I need to hire? What skills do I need to build as an individual? Both parties are feeling this growing tension because it's been proven that the shelf life value of a technical skill, a hard skill, has been declining. It used to be about 50 years, and now, and this feels really uncomfortable and unsatisfying for a lot of people, like, wait, I was told I go study something, double down, find my career track, I'm good. And now I've got to learn new stuff, maybe pivot into a new career path if I chose something like banking, oopsie. Then, you know, I've got to go into fintech and I don't know anything about fintech. So a lot of those are the things that really were accelerated by the pandemic.
The role of employers has kind of changed. you know, they're having to educate their employees. And so what does that look like? You know, you talk about learning velocity, and now a lot of these companies are putting in workplace educational programs to actually make sure that their employees have the skills, and they're taking that burden on themselves. So what are you seeing within these companies, and how are they addressing that need to educate their employees?
Not a lot that's getting me excited, if I'm honest. I'd love you to tell me the companies that are really taking on that burden of educating their people, because it's crickets when I ask around to the people I know, hey, is your company really aware of that? What the biggest knee-jerk reaction, well, I'm seeing a lot of strange knee-jerk reactions by companies today, but the first one is, we got a recruiting problem. Limited supply. People are quitting. We can't find the people we need. We can't hold on to the people we need. We can't find the skills that we need. And my response to that is, well, I don't think you have a recruiting problem. And they go, yeah, we do. We can't find the people. I said, well, you've got an attrition problem. But you've known for a while that people are not going to stay in companies longer. This is the part that was really helps me get into the heads of leaders. You say, hey, are people leaving your company faster than ever? Yep. Do you think it's going to change in the future? Nope. Okay, so what are you doing about that? What you're doing is you're pretending it's not happening. You're not changing how you design work to expect people to leave. I was in Atlanta last week. I met a head of manufacturing. He goes, Steve, it takes me 6 years to train someone to work at this printing press. And he goes, and then after 7 years, they leave. And I'm going, well, that's a design problem. That's not a recruiting problem. You need to re-engineer that job so it doesn't take you 6 years for someone to do that. Maybe it's a shared job. Maybe it's something different. And I think we're seeing in technology, and you guys have been working in the technology landscape, I mean, what I love about doing talent work in technology companies is the migration of appreciation and the acceptance of experimenting with culture is easier because that's how you build software. It's an A-B test. You try this, you try that, you see what works, you double down on it. And a lot of companies that are not, the DNA is not software development. It's like a foreign act to experiment. Oh, we can't do that. We've got to be in control. We got to have a one-size-fit-all solution. And it doesn't work like that. And so a lot of the industries, let's take hospitality, are on their heels because they've never had to fight for talent before. They've never had to really get creative. And I didn't hire a single software engineer or technologist at LinkedIn in the 4 years I was there that didn't have 3 to 5 offers. And so in that domain, we have to be really competitive and really think about, you know, why does someone want to work here? What's our value proposition? How are we different? And it's really a cultural conversation, not a, oh, we need to raise the pay, if you will. So I'm seeing deer in the headlights right now, frankly. I wish I was seeing more. I do believe the future is exactly what you said, which is if you want to keep someone longer, you have to make it more possible for them to leave, which means you make them better. And that's part of what I've tried to get across in my book, which is, isn't the more honest conversation with an employee saying, I care about you for your whole future than only when you work for me? Isn't that really what someone wants, is a leader or a company or an organization that's got their back for their career? Because companies change, people change. No one can really believe that one organization is going to meet their needs for the entirety of their career. That's just silly. It doesn't work anymore like that in most jobs, right? So anyway, so that's just how I think about it. I think the future will be that, and I was having a conversation about this yesterday with the venture firm that's thinking about investing in a skill assessment company that they were looking at, and they asked me for my opinion. And I said, listen, in the world of skill and talent development, what I'm starting to see is most organizations have a training department that sits in HR. And when times get tough, that department gets laid off because we don't have the extra budget to, you know, bring in speakers. And training is moving from HR into the core, which is how fast you can learn, how quickly you can raise the skill level of your team is really your competitive advantage. And that's why I say in my book, I really feel we're not too far away from a world where recruiting is going to be based more on what you can learn than what you know. Because I know whatever business I'm in, it's going to be different tomorrow. So my success tomorrow is going to be based on how versatile my team is. And so I need to know that you can learn new stuff. And I don't know how much you guys have done recruiting in your day, but I'll tell you, in the last 10 years that I've been recruiting, a job description that you write with a hiring manager is valuable and accurate for about 2 months. So why are you hiring someone to do that? Why aren't you hiring someone to do what's after that? And that feels very uncomfortable for organizations that, well, I need the experience. I know. But that experience is only going to be valuable to you for a finite period. Don't you want to hire someone and be able to recognize someone who can learn and grow, right? And I think that's really, really a fundamental mind shift that we're struggling with right now, because we're humans and we don't like all this change. And so we want to go back to what we know, right? And that's a big problem.
Yeah. And as somebody who is young like myself, I'm just now getting started in the tech and software field. And when I hear you say you need to be somebody who's willing to learn and willing to be trained, what kind of things should I be very self-aware of in myself or trying to foster in myself to be somebody who can be trained and learn very easily? Like, what are you trying to spot in those people when you're recruiting that you can tell, hey, this is somebody who's going to be able to come on and learn quickly? Is it mostly on that individual, or is it a lot of the processes in the business, or is it a mixture of both?
Oh, first, I'd just like to say this is a beautiful moment, because you asking me that question tells me that you're curious, that you're listening to what I'm saying, and that you're going ahead. Right? I gave you some information and you immediately thought, okay, well, if that's true, then what next? And that's sort of like, I'm seeing that in action as someone who's interviewed more people than I can count. I mean, we're talking about, let me speak in generalities, which is feels unsatisfying, and then I'll get to some more specifics. I'm looking for curiosity. I'm looking for a growth mindset. I'm looking for someone who's a self-study and doesn't need to be told what to learn. I'm looking for someone who, you know, more often than not has created something from nothing, or you know, I've got a friend who teaches themselves how to take apart and put it back together, like computers or technologies in their home. Like, why? Because I'm curious. That's why. You know, and so I want to see people take untraditional places. I look for people who've lived in different countries and different cultures and different experiences. You know, I had a really interesting sort of conversation slash debate with someone the other day where I said, I believe that I learned more how to be a great human resource executive in the gymnasium of my university than I did in the library, because my profession today is all about seeing how people handle different situations and matching people and coaches and teams well together. And that was all about just the curiosity of like, hey, how do you handle loss? How do you handle defeat? How do you handle being behind in a game? How do you handle victory? How do you handle someone on your team that you don't like playing with, but you got to play with them nice to win? Like, I want to understand all that stuff just because I'm super, super curious. So I think we're going to get better at this in the future. And more importantly to your question, I think we need to deliver work to our employees, or design work so the people are learning while they're adding value. This is where I think we've got training wrong. Training, we think, oh, we've got to bring in a speaker, a teacher, someone, an expert to tell us what to do. I don't think that is the optimal way. I think it's, I want to give you a new assignment, a new project. I want you to work on this different team for a couple of weeks. I want you to go to this country and tackle this project and see how they approach technical problems differently than you do. And that is highly, highly energy producing. And that's why I think, you know, I worked at LinkedIn. This is a, you know, a story that not a lot of people pay attention to because they're so wrapped up in you have to be somewhere a long time before I trust you and you add value. And if you're not here a long time, company's going to fail. The median tenure the entire time I was at LinkedIn was 9 months. 9 months. We doubled the staff every year. So I'm like, and afterwards, it took me years. So like, well, how did we do that? Because everyone just got here. Like, they just figured out where the free food was, and we doubled revenue. And it wasn't because the product was easy or the business was simple. It wasn't. It was a very complicated business, more complicated than any other social network, including Google's model, which is highly advertising revenue driven, right? We've got like an advertising business. We've got a sales business. We've got a recruiting business. We've got the free business because we want you to use the site. And we had all kinds of different models, and it was really hard. And what was happening was my senior leaders were recruiting, and their lieutenants were being asked to be the interim heads of their organizations, and they were just fired up. And on paper, they weren't qualified to do those jobs. And so, and that's where sort of I'm leaning, and it's probably the next book I want to write, which is I really saw talent trump experience time and time and time again. And that's why I'm trying to help people understand, like, you give something maybe ahead or more of what someone should be able to do, I think you're going to be shocked. But no, I got to see the experience or I can't hire you. Yeah, but when have you been most excited in your career journey? Doing the same thing 5 years or taking on something new? You know, and that's why I think people are flocking to startup land. That's why I think big companies, and I talk about this in my book, are trying to look and present themselves to candidates like they're a startup. Like, hey, we're a startup. No, you've got 50,000 people. Like, how can you be a startup? Oh, yeah, we're lean and nimble and, you know, we move fast and we got free Coke over there. Like, no, that's not a startup. Like, okay, can I make a decision just to do this in my job? No, you can't. You need to ask six people for permission to have six meetings before we can even think that we could give you the responsibility to make that. Okay. So we got a ways to go, but I'm encouraged, you know, and I think this, back to circling around to your question around, so being able to identify that and to build it into your organization so you're unlocking that, I think it's going to be a real, call it the holy grail of talent in the future.
If you enjoyed that conversation, you can find the full interview on the Middle Tech podcast feed on your favorite podcast platform, or you can visit us at middletech.com. For those unfamiliar with Middle Tech, we exist to grow the startup and tech ecosystem in this region through media. We've been around for about 4 years now, talking with some of the top entrepreneurs in this region. For WEKU and Eastern Standard, I'm Logan Jones, co-host and executive producer of the Middle Tech podcast. Thanks for listening.
With us from Nashville, Brassfield, Jesse Rose, her husband Chadley, and his brother Bradley. Hello, you all. Welcome to Eastern Standard.
What's up?
So I've been listening a lot to you guys, and you have the thing that really leaps out of the speakers for me is your vocal blend. It's incredibly tight. And so, Chadley and Bradley, let's start with you. I know you spent a lifetime in music. You grew up in Tupelo, Mississippi. Is that right?
Chadley here, that's correct. We grew up in Tupelo, and as you know, there's a guy named Elvis from Tupelo, and he's our hero, and we grew up singing in church, so I think that's probably where a lot of the vocal blend came from, you know, as a family, just singing in church all the time.
Then how did you all wind up in Nashville?
Brad, do you want to take that one over?
Well, I don't really know. I remember Chadley and I, there's a small college in North Mississippi that we got a full ride scholarship to do country music called Campus Country. And we did a year there, and I decided, well, I could be in Nashville doing this instead. And then we met our manager at that time, who invited me to come live up here and get it acclimated with the studio and how to play, how to sing in it. And then about 6 months later, I told Chadley to join me. We've been here ever since. It's going to be almost 12 years for me. Pretty cool.
Did I hear right? Did you say that you got a full ride scholarship to do specifically country music?
Specifically country music.
Wow.
Yes. It was so weird. They paid everything, room and board and everything else. To go play country music.
And where was that again?
It was Northeast
Community College in Boonville, Mississippi.
Wow.
Boonville, yeah.
That's really cool.
We would go around high schools and stuff and play music, and, you know, we'd pull out some Garth Brooks and stuff and tell them, hey, it's cool to go to college. That was our job, you know.
Well, yeah, that would pretty much sell it, I would think. Jesse Rose, I know that you've also been using that awesome voice of yours all of your life, and I know that from experience because I had the good fortune of being in a band with you called The City for a while.
Yes, it was my first band ever. That's where I learned how to be in a band, was with you and Maggie and Brian and Keith and Gene.
Yeah, that was so much fun. Well,
it was so much fun.
What about you guys? Did something kind of click when the three of you sang together for the first time? What was that like?
Well, so this is Chadley again. So I'll take this one over. So Bradley and I were in a trio with another girl that didn't work out. And she kind of had aspirations of being a solo artist. And during that time, Jesse and I had been writing songs anyways. And as you know, Jesse can sing with anyone. She can sing with a wall if she wanted to. She's that great.
Yep.
She's been in the studio since she was a little girl. And so, you know, she came into our group, like, you know, harmonies that I had been singing for years that I thought I was doing great. You know, she would be like, I think you're a little, you know, half step off here or whatever. And so I think that that's kind of how we knew that it was just perfection, you know, perfect for us.
Well, I know you guys are doing a lot of recording, and we're going to talk about that in just a minute, but let's go over to the live music side. Live music sure has taken quite a hit over the past couple of years, with so many venues closed or very limited on their crowds because of COVID. How are things looking now?
So when COVID hit, we lost at least 100 gigs, and we're all full-time musicians. And so it was pretty devastating. I'm not quite sure how we made it, but luckily Nashville is alive and well, and we're busier than ever right now. There's a dot on every day of my iPhone calendar.
Oh, wow. That's great. Well,
yeah.
Jesse, you certainly are a gifted musician in your own right, but it seems certain that there are some genes going on there. Your dad... J.P. Pennington, co-founder of Exile, and then I believe your grandmother is one of the original Coon Creek girls, right? Lily Mae Ledford?
Yes, Lily Mae Ledford was my grandmother. And so I grew up in a household that was always full of music, and I went to school for music too. So I always say that I got my classical side of training in school with my music theory and voice lessons, and then when I went home, it was like a commercial music, country music lesson every day.
Well, I know that your brother James is also a singer, and your mom is an amazing dancer, so it's just an incredible household of music.
Yes, and both my parents are songwriters, and so I learned how to write a song at home, and my brother is also a fabulous singer. He does barbershop, and he's got one of the finest musical ears of anyone that I know. So yeah, it was music all the time. It was fun growing up.
What would be your message to others like you who are listening right now who hope to someday be doing their own radio interviews from Nashville?
I would say that the biggest advice I could give is to move to a music city. That's probably the number one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Start meeting people. It's all about who you know. And we're still, you know, making contacts every day. This town is, you know, it seems huge, and then at times it seems small. It's like the same circle of writers writing everything. So it's important to get out and mingle. And then secondly, I would say you got to show up to the game and, you know, take a swing. And that's the only way to get anywhere in this town. It's like, if you want to be good at songwriting, well, my advice is to write songs constantly. And you're going to write a bunch of crappy ones until eventually you write a good one. Then all of a sudden, you know, the songs that you used to write aren't so precious to you anymore. And I think that that's my advice.
That was good advice, Jenna.
Well, you know, it might seem obvious that you would want to gravitate to a music city, but there is a lot that really kind of goes on behind the scenes, isn't there? I mean, it's a networking thing that you're looking for. Am I right about that?
Yeah, and it's almost more important than anything else. You know, it's like I know friends of mine who are so talented that, you know, that they don't go out and meet people, and it's just impossible to get anywhere without the right connections. You know, it'd be like Michael Jordan playing high school basketball, you know, somewhere that no one knows and never get discovered. You know, it's just you gotta get out there and meet people and play against the best and sing, you know, as much as you can, play as many writers' rounds as you can. You know, just honing your craft.
Persistence. It takes a lot of persistence.
That's another one. Yeah, it's not for the faint of heart.
That's right. Yeah. Well, one way to get it out there is to record it. And I know that you have a recording project underway. Tell us about that.
Yes, we're so excited. We are getting ready to record a new project with our friend and hit producer, Oscar Charles. And we've known Oscar for a really long time, and we've been waiting for the perfect time to make this project, and we feel like it's finally arrived, and he knows us really well. He knows our sound. We love his talent as a producer, and it's just a great fit. We're so excited to be recording a project of songs that we've written.
All right, we're going to go out with a track that you provided to us. Tell us about this song.
Let's do Sitting on a Rock. So this is a single we released last summer, and it's a really fun summertime sing-along song, and I hope you enjoy it.
All right, that's Brassfield, Chadley, Bradley, and Jesse Rose. Thank you all.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
jet planes in the sky. Summer coming, summer saying goodbye. On the road, horns are honking. Downtown, there's people honky tonking. It's a busy world. Yeah, there's no place I'd rather be, girl, than sitting on a rock down by the river, my feet in the water with you. Sitting on a rock down by the river with my feet in the water with you. We kiss, boats roll, a fish jumping, putting on a show, making ripples in the water. The sun's going down, but it keeps getting hotter. Ooh, yeah, baby, kiss me one more time. Ooh, yeah, it's all good as long as I'm sitting on a rock down by the river, my feet in the water with you. I'm sitting on a rock down by the river with my feet in the water with you. Well, now nobody knows where it is we go to get our toes a little wet. It's the stars and the crickets, and baby, that's a ticket to a night we won't forget. Whoa, whoa.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Sitting on a Rock by Brassfield. We're online at weku.org or esweku.org and the WEKU app, NPR One, and the Google News app. Would you like to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.